Good afternoon. Welcome to the Democracy Forum. This is the first program in our series in 2026 to broadcast at this time on the third Friday of each month. We're featuring topics in Maine's participatory democracy, encouraging citizens to take an active role in government and politics. This program is a project of the League of Women Voters Down East, produced in cooperation with WERU-FM Community Radio. Our conversation today is about constitutional crisis. Can democracy survive billionaire economics? We'll talk about how wealth and income inequality undermine democracy. Does extreme inequality lead to right-wing authoritarianism? How does that work? Are we seeing that play out in the U.S. right now, in Maine even? This show was pre-recorded on January 13th. Send your comments to news@weru.org. Please put Democracy Forum in the subject line. This is Ann Luther from the League of Women Voters of Maine. I'll be your host for the Democracy Forum. Let me introduce our guests. First, Garrett Martin. Garrett is the president and CEO of the Maine Center for Economic Policy. Welcome, Garrett. So pleased to have you.
Glad to be here. Thanks, Ann.
And Susan Stokes is the Tiffany and Margaret Blake Distinguished Service Professor, Department of Political Science at the University of Chicago. She's also the author of the new book, The Backsliders, Why Leaders Undermine Their Own Democracies. Welcome, Susan.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
So let's get started. Susan, I'll lead off and just ask you to describe your work linking extreme income inequality to right-wing authoritarianism. What has your research found?
Well, what I'm interested in is what we call democratic backsliding, which means elected leaders, presidents and prime ministers in countries around the world who are elected in free and fair elections, civilian leaders who sort of turn around and immediately start undermining their own democratic institution. They undercut the freedom of the press. They undermine the independence of the courts. They sort of marginalize their legislatures and so on and so forth. And that is, to some extent, one of the kinds of leaders who fit that description are right-wing, what I call right-wing ethno-nationalist leaders. But there also are elsewhere in the world left-wing populist leaders who sort of fit that description. And throwing all of those folks into one bucket, what we find is that income inequality is the most robust predictor of which countries will experience democratic backsliding, which countries will bring to office a leader who behaves in that way. So it isn't necessarily the case that the poorest countries or the most unequal countries are bound to have that kind of experience, but it's a kind of it's a factor that works on countries. So, for example, South Africa is the most unequal democracy in the world, and it indeed did experience a period of democratic backsliding in around 2018, and that's what we see in the United States as well. The U.S., as is well known, is a very unequal country by the standards of wealthy democracies, and we have seen, as in other places, the rise of right-wing ethno-nationalist faction of a party or takeover of a party, which has led to democratic backsliding.
Like, what's the causality there? How does one lead to the other, do you think?
Yeah, well, it's a great question. Thank you. That's what my book sort of puts together. So there's a lot of connective tissue between income inequality and the erosion of democracy. Some of it has to do with the kind of natural rise of a kind of grievance culture, a sense of being marginalized, a sense of wealthy, powerful people sort of casting aside a lot of the population and not caring if people have a sense that their children aren't going to have the same prospects that they have. And that sense of grievance, of frustrated ambitions can be made use of by populist leaders who offer some kinds of sort of simple solutions or simply kind of feed a kind of polarized environment. And then polarization is another part of the connective tissue. So places that have highly unequal distributions of income and wealth tend to be more politically polarized for various reasons. And polarization is a key factor in democratic backsliding. It tends to make people say to themselves, well, I don't really like what he says about the press. I don't really like the way he's manipulating the court, but God forbid that the other side come to power. And so they are more tolerant in a polarized public tends to be more tolerant of those kind of attacks on democracy.
What do you make of that, Garrett?
There's a lot of resonance and there's a lot of eerie familiarity in this moment. I think, you know, the other piece we certainly look at as we think about these issues is the relationship between what are the causal links to income inequality and accumulation of wealth. And I think there is a governance tie in there, which is that part of what powerful elites want to do is retain that wealth and power and privilege. And so one way they do that is by co-opting the levers of government to their advantage. And so I think it is interesting to your question, Anne, about the cause and effect of sort of how that plays out over time. And certainly in this country, we have some interesting points in our history where, you know, the Gilded Age, for instance, is a period in which we had some of the highest levels of inequality we've seen in this country. And it was certainly a period of tremendous corruption and sort of perilous points in time for us historically. You know, the reality is where we are presently in this country in terms of income inequality is as high as we've ever seen it. So it outstrips those periods. And I think it's in some ways no surprise, based in part on the research that Dr. Stokes has done, that, you know, this connection is, and the reason we're having this conversation is now.
But, you know, I mean, it's not like, there's a politics of resentment. There was that great book that came out, you know, right around 2016, 2017, about the politics of resentment. But it's not exactly like the people who are downtrodden and resentful elect somebody that they know is going to disenfranchise them or do the democratic backsliding that you talk about. That's not exactly what's happening, is it, Susan?
First, let me say that I entirely agree with Garrett. Please call me Sue.
Okay.
And you know, and he makes an excellent point about the sort of resonances with an earlier period in U.S. history. I also would say that the connection between income inequality and democratic backsliding helps to explain why the world, not just the U.S., but the world is experiencing a wave of democratic backsliding at this particular moment after a period of globalization, trade liberalization, and the like that tended to encourage income inequality in a lot of places. Now that took different forms in different places. Income inequality, I'm going to agree with Garrett that income inequality also has sort of anti-democratic effects on people at the top of the income structure. They have a lot at stake in you know, deregulation, in certain kinds of positive public policy, in protecting what they have. And so, and then their resources give them, you know, many ways to influence, you know, who wins elections, who gets to campaign, and so on. And so, so it isn't just, the effect isn't just of sort of fomenting a grievance culture at the bottom. It's also a kind of anti-democratic kind of culture at the top.
Yeah. And so what are examples that we see internationally as well as in the U.S. right now? And then I'm going to ask Garrett to talk about what we see happening in Maine.
You know, some examples. So in Latin America, Mexico, from 2018 to 2024, the president was a man named Andrés Manuel López Obrador, who is a leftist. You know, he came from his political trajectory was through left-wing parties. And he was sort of pro-redistributive and very much kind of elevates indigenous peoples and people of color and the downtrodden in his country, and also very committed to undermining the, you know, independence of Mexico's very admirable election administration body that was so important in the transition to democracy in that country a few years back. And was very critical of the independent federal courts there. In fact, introduced a constitutional change that now Mexico's federal judges from bottom to top are elected. So their Supreme Court is now elected. And that was a way, a kind of covert way of giving his political party control over the judiciary. So, you know, why do you see that in Mexico? Mexico is an unequal country. It's a country with a long history of extreme poverty in many of the rural areas. And somebody like López Obrador is able to come in and say, the political class as a whole and the elite as a whole is against you, and we won't be able to solve these problems until you give me all the power. And you know, and it's very resonant for people there to hear that, you know, the court's not democratic. The court isn't elected. Who elected the judges? Just as we hear that sometimes in the United States today. And so there's a kind of the inequality and the struggles that people have in their daily lives leave them open to a discourse of if we're going to make things better, we need to get, you know, take down these institutions that presumably are getting in the way of progress, where really I think what they're getting in the way of is power control by the president. So that's an example of a kind of leftist version of democratic erosion fed by income polarization, partisan polarization, and the like.
This is a worldwide effect, though. Like, the global economy is unequal, right?
Yeah. And, you know, the other common pattern is right-wing ethno-nationalists who that's a very common pattern as well. So you know, we see that in our own country. And that also is a byproduct of income inequality and the sort of backdrop of a kind of convergence in earlier decades of the kind of legacy right and left, or if you want in the U.S., the Democrats and Republicans, converging on a position of globalization, of open markets, and of tolerating and the left, or the center left parties in the U.S. and in most of the other advanced democracies, certainly throughout Europe, sort of turning their attention more to middle class, urbanite, educated, socially liberal voters, and somewhat away from working class voters, and moving away from connections with labor unions. To some degree, so that opened space for these kind of right-wing populists who came in and adopted a more economic nationalist kind of discourse, a somewhat more pro-social spending, but not nearly as much as the traditional left, and also a very xenophobic and very kind of us versus them notion of national identity.
Yeah, I mean, you're really building a link in this conversation that puts wealth and income inequality and political polarization in the same conversation, which I find so interesting.
And that it can show up on both sides of the spectrum. You know, I think that's one thing that's interesting in Sue's research is this point that it's not just a phenomenon of, you know, one political dynamic or another. You have authoritarian sort of neo-nationalist types of entities, and then you have these very populist left-wing. And I think the example that here in the States is, you know, the first election that Trump won was one in which Bernie Sanders was prominent in the Democratic primary, and there were a lot of people who were supporters of Bernie who ultimately voted for Trump. And I think it was because that they were both speaking to the same grievance structure that people had, you know, that our kids aren't going to have a better opportunity than we are to sort of live the kind of life that we did. And, you know, things have gotten worse for us economically. And these are the two people who seem to be speaking to that. Now, I think where the difference comes in is, and we've seen this historically, we tend to ebb and flow with this stuff, right? Again, I referenced the Gilded Age earlier in the United States. But the difference in my mind, at least, is the difference, and it's laid out in Sue's work too, is this sort of notion of consolidating power versus a power reset. And, you know, I think when you look at what happened with the New Deal and that era post-Depression, that was a resetting of power. It was restructuring how government worked to ensure that the regulations were in place to protect people and their resources, that programs were in place to mitigate, you know, poverty and some of the deficits that people were dealing with after the Great Depression. And, you know, arguably there were ways in which they sought to consolidate power, but they still at a fundamental level respected both the electoral process and the structures of government that we all should be learning about when we do social studies in school, you know, primarily the three branches of government. And that's very different, though, than the sort of power consolidation model that I think these folks who are ready to just come in and have it my way or the highway, and serve it up to, you know, the oligarchs and that class. So I think that is a very interesting distinction. And I think sometimes the authoritarian cadre likes to use the same terminology that folks who are just trying to reset power and recognize this imbalance and how the system's been rigged against working people, to sort of soft pedal what they're doing. And I think that that's where we've gotten into trouble, is when we've allowed those folks to have free rein. And, you know, what ultimately does it take to stop it? And if elections work, theoretically, that's the ultimate accountability. But if the electoral process and system has been completely degraded, that's when you really are at a loss in some respects.
You're tuned to the Democracy Forum on WERU-FM. This is Ann Luther of the League of Women Voters of Maine. Our topic today is constitutional crisis. Can democracy survive billionaire economics? Our guests this afternoon are Sue Stokes, the Tiffany and Margaret Blake Distinguished Service Professor at the Department of Political Science, the University of Chicago, and from Maine, Garrett Martin, President and CEO of the Maine Center for Economic Policy. This program was pre-recorded on January 13th. No listener calls are being taken. All right, Sue, to what Garrett said.
Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, right? They absolutely right. They, in some ways, they are striking similar chords. Their messages of economic nationalism and the frustrations of the working classes are very very resonant with one another. One of the big differences is Donald Trump is an ethno-nationalist and has a vision of what it means to be American that includes religious and ethnic identities, whereas Sanders's notion of Americanness is a civic nationalism. So you're an American if you are an American citizen, and you hold to certain kinds of values and commitments. And so that's very different, and they sound very different. And one of the nerdy things that I do in my book is actually subject their discourse to comparison, and you can see that they are similar in a lot of ways. They talk about, they say, critical things about rich people, and they say critical things about corporations. Of course, Donald Trump also turns around and says and brags about how he is a rich person. So there's a little bit of a, antimonies there. But where they really differ is in the way they talk about ethnic minorities. And you can see that, you can hear it, and you can also see it in the data if you want to be persuaded by hard data that is true. It is. Now, one of the things I'd add is that there's a lasting tension in the Republican Party and in the sort of MAGA world between a more authentically populist set of positions and a kind of ersatz populism. So in general, in Europe, the right-wing ethno-nationalist parties sort of locate themselves in between the legacy right and legacy left in terms of how much of a generous social welfare state should there be. So they're more generous than the legacy right, less than the legacy left. In the United States, the Republican Party under MAGA really is still pulling much more toward a kind of, they would hate this, but a kind of traditional rhino sort of position when it comes to spending and so and social programs. And they gloss the opposition, say, to extending the ACA benefits. They'll gloss that as, well, we're fighting fraud, we're against fraud and inefficiency, but in fact they're sort of caught between a sort of constituency, both voters but also donors and potentates behind the scenes, who are just just are anti-state and don't see any benefits to social programs because they don't need them and their children aren't going to need them, and a voting constituency that is this sort of populist crowd, low-income folks who would be who would also tend to greet Bernie Sanders's discourse with quite a bit of enthusiasm as well.
I mean, I'm interested in what Garrett was saying about the reset versus the consolidators, right? I mean, that's kind of the difference between, let's say, FDR and Trump. So go ahead, Garrett, you were going to work in here.
Well, I think to put a finer point on it, as we think about these ideas and terminology here in the United States, it's about race, right? And so there's no question that racism at the most basic level has been used to thwart progress and a more equal sort of system of taxation, a more equal delivery of public services, a more equal rendering of public structures like educational systems, housing, to support, you know, broader community sensibilities. And that it is that long march. One of the most diverse periods of time in the South Carolina legislature was immediately after the Civil War. And there were Black lawmakers in the legislative body. And the minute it started to look like they were going to actually have real power, the backlash was pronounced. And, you know, that era got buried in the history books. And I think that that's one thing we still struggle with. You know, you have President Trump the other day in an interview with the New York Times saying that, you know, the civil rights movement fundamentally, you know, hurt white people. So he's still playing that grievance card. What's so interesting to me about this is that the reality is when you talk to people at a human level and you strip away any sort of political identifiers on a lot of the policies and issues and perspectives in play, most people fundamentally agree with the idea that the system is rigged. They may differ in who's rigging it, but they do know that the wealthy aren't paying their fair share, for instance, as it relates to taxation, that certain services aren't necessarily benefiting them, and that the deck is stacked against them in some ways. And so that piece and some of the remedies to that are fairly common. But just to tie this point up, and, you know, there's another book that was written by a woman, Vanessa Williamson, The Price of Democracy, The Revolutionary Power of Taxation in American History. And one of the things she writes in her book is that in the long reaction to the civil rights movement, a radical anti-tax faction pushed the Republican Party to such an extreme that it abandoned first its commitment to governance and then its commitment to electoral democracy. Her point is where we are now was 50 years in the making. Actually, a little bit longer if you go back to the 1960s. And that's where the challenge is.
Talking about the racial element here, I wonder, though, if racism is the point or if racism is a tool that is used to divide and polarize people, where the real end is not ethno cleansing or whatever, but where the real end is actually the accumulation and consolidation of power. And they're just using that in order to get their hands on the levers of government. What do you think, Sue?
I think that there are real racists, literal old-fashioned racists, who are in positions of power at the moment in the United States, who really, you know, think that minority groups are inferior in an inherent way. And, you know, and they play that out. And I also think that it's a tool. I also think it's a method, exactly as Garrett was saying, of getting people to think, you know, social spending goes to other people, you know, and guess who the other people are? It's not for people like us. The only thing I'd add to that is that there are versions of that around the world. And so more generically, it's a sort of othering. It's a sort of blaming of some kind of identity other. And it is, you know, it might be Muslims in, you know, in Hungary. It might be the insufficiently devout in Turkey. It might be the, you know, neoliberals in Mexico. And, you know, there are different, you know, sort of plug in your category. And the other piece of it is that, you know, I think right-wing ethno-nationalism in the world today is also intimately bound up in anti-immigrant sentiment or anti-migrant sentiment. So beyond, you know, whatever sort of effects on labor markets and control of the border and so on and so forth, you know, the extreme language generating disgust and hatred and fear of people who come from other countries is really startling. You know, when you get to the point of, you know, those people eat your pets, that is, you know, that's tapping into very, very deep-seated feelings of disgust in that case, but also with other kinds of discourse, fear, anger, hatred, that are useful for politicians because they get people to act, they get them to come out, go to rallies, go to the voting booth, go, you know, grab their, you know, whatever, and go intimidate people or get on the internet and troll. And so those are, you know, have deep roots, as Garrett was saying, in American history and in our country's very troubled history of anti-Black racism. But there also is a kind of version of that that has slightly different, you know, it comes in slightly different chords in other countries, in other countries that are experiencing right-wing ethno-nationalism.
But your point being that it's useful to the consolidation of power and the erosion of democratic rights, you know?
Absolutely.
We have a very clear example of that the first time Paula Page ran for office.
I was hoping you'd turn it to Maine. Go ahead, talk.
Yeah, you know, and that was, he produced an ad, his campaign produced an ad that basically the imagery was of somebody kind of crossing the border in, you know, Texas, walking through a tunnel and water leaking down. And, you know, and the upshot was, and this was in the campaign against Mike Michaud, the upshot was, you know, these people are taking your benefits, basically. What we know from people who were out knocking on doors and talking to voters was that was a very compelling ad. And it was an ad that they didn't have a response to because it just triggered that sort of deeply felt sensibility that somebody else is getting a better deal than I am. And, you know, that's another really important part of the playbook here is, and I appreciate your question about sort of, is it really ultimately the goal for them, or is it about consolidating power? And I think it's a both and, as Sue said. But I think, you know, the real goal is to divert people's attention with these culture war, identity war type of issues so that you're punching sideways rather than punching up. And what I mean by that is, you know, or punching down, right? So if I'm pissed off about my neighbor next door who's getting something that I don't feel like I'm getting, when we're both, quite frankly, getting screwed by the fact that, you know, the state just cut income taxes that disproportionately benefit, you know, the rich guy who lives across town on the waterfront, we're never going to get anywhere. And in fact, we may actually be losing ground in our shared concern about how our livelihoods are making it harder and harder for us to keep a grasp on the sort of experience that we have in the economy. And that's effectively what has happened in this country. You know, you see a very clear divergence in the late 70s between productivity gains over time and wage growth over time in this country. And what that has meant is that for families, their ability to sort of hold on to kind of a middle class lifestyle, if you will, one with reasonable comfort and economic security and future, you know, aspirations and those kinds of things, has gotten harder and harder. You know, what did families do? Well, they started working more. They started relying on debt. They started foregoing savings and, you know, their retirement or their children's education. Also, meanwhile, right, education, healthcare, and housing have all skyrocketed in their costs. And so, you know, it's interesting that sort of in this moment, what seems to be getting people's attention are two things as it relates to sort of potentially stopping this sort of steamroller effect that we're seeing with the Trump administration. One is the Epstein files, which that's a whole different conversation. But the other is this quote unquote affordability crisis. And so I think if the next election cycle is waged on the grounds of the affordability crisis, that may lead to a different outcome. And it's interesting to note that you see, you know, just today there are reports about President Trump contacting Elizabeth Warren to talk to her about capping credit card interest rates, right? So, I mean, one thing that's interesting about Trump is he is a populist in many respects, or at least he pitches himself as a populist without necessarily delivering the policies that are ultimately going to speak to the needs of the people that, you know, and that's why this sort of breakup with Marjorie Taylor Greene is so interesting and telling, because I think she's really naming what she's observing, which is that he sold us one bill of goods, but in fact, what he's doing is very different from that. And it's being dictated by the likes of, you know, Russell Vogt and Stephen Miller and folks who really have a much more insidious agenda about collecting and consolidating power than any sort of, you know, you or I might scheme up.
You're tuned to the Democracy Forum on WERU. This is Ann Luther of the League of Women Voters of Maine. Our guests this afternoon are Garrett Martin, President and CEO of the Maine Center for Economic Policy, and Sue Stokes, the Tiffany and Margaret Blake Distinguished Service Professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Chicago. Our topic today is constitutional crisis. Can democracy survive billionaire economics? This show was pre-recorded. Send your comments or questions to news@weru.org. Please put Democracy Forum in the subject line. So do we see this phenomenon playing out in the U.S. on a geographic basis? For example, is wealth and income inequality more extreme in red states than blue states, Sue?
No, I don't have recent data on that. Maybe Garrett may be better positioned to answer that question. One study I've read that's making that link that I mentioned earlier between income inequality and partisan polarization, I believe some of that result is driven by very high levels of income inequality in, you know, in red states. But maybe Garrett has a more up-to-date answer to that question.
Yeah, and in terms of, you know, applying this on a state by state basis, it's a little mixed, I would say. And part of the reason it's mixed is just because of the way our economy is structured. So New York State actually has some of the highest levels of inequality, right? California has some of the highest levels of inequality. Well, duh, that's not a surprise to anybody. Is it fundamentally about the policies of that state that are what have resulted in that? No, it's actually not. Because in truth, lower income individuals in those states are doing better off in, you know, relative terms, in terms of their access to certain services and healthcare and whatnot, than, for instance, residents in another state that also has high levels of inequality, which is Florida or Mississippi or Louisiana. Those states are kind of in league with each other in terms of their levels of inequality. You know, the flip side is if you're a relatively poor state, then you're going to have less inequality, right? So, you know, Maine tends to be kind of in the middle of the pack to lower down. And part of that is the dynamics of our economy. Part of it is the sort of the, you know, where we are in the New England, as Angus King likes to say, we're the cul-de-sac of New England or the United States. But I think that that's an important part of the story. But the other piece, though, that's really important is what are the prospects going forward for people in those states? And what structures are being put in place that either mimic what we're seeing at the federal level and therefore actually truly make it harder for people, or that are sort of pushing back or thwarting that kind of ethos that may be coming in or being pushed in from afar. And so, you know, it's no surprise when you look at the states that are being targeted for these ICE actions, right? They are led by Democrats. You know, Maine is an interesting state. If you go back to Sue's original, some of her research, where she talks about, again, kind of horizontal erosion, where you're going after the legislative, the judicial, that kind of thing. And then also the more vertical erosion, where you're going after the systems of elections. Well, we're very lucky in Maine, right? What was one of the first things Paul LePage did when he came into office the first time? He tried to get rid of same-day voter registration. And it was actually Mainers themselves who rose up in a popular referendum and said, no, that's not what we want. We want to have free and fair elections in the state that make it possible for all people to vote. That was just reflected again in this most recent ballot initiative where people said, we're going to save, you know, absentee voting because we want as many people to be able to participate in this process as possible because that's how we actually are truly a democratic state. I think the other thing in Maine that sets us apart from most states, right, is our publicly financed elections. That is a difference maker in terms of who can run and whose voices are ultimately heard. And that's fundamentally when you talk about power and when you talk about structures of governance, it is really a litmus test to say, do you have structures of government and do you have structures of power in place that are making it possible for a broader swath of people to participate and be heard and engage? Or are you trying to consolidate and lessen how many voices have a seat at the table, and what their influence looks like in that process. And at least in Maine, we've done a pretty good job of trying to keep it as broad as possible. And I think you see that reflected in the way our state legislature conducts its work. You know, what is troubling, though, is that we're not immune to identity politics in Maine. So historically, you know, Maine, we have some of the highest levels of participation in our elections of any state. Historically, even as early as recently as 2014, a significant share of Maine people would split their ticket. What does that mean? It means that they voted for one candidate at the top of the ticket, a presidential candidate, for instance, who was of one party, but for their local legislature, they voted for someone of a different party. In 2014, 41% of the electorate in Maine were ticket splitters. You know, we can all appreciate that, like, Olympia Snow was a very popular Republican, and therefore, or, you know, Angus King is a popular independent, and therefore, so on and so forth. But I think the point is, over time, we've seen an erosion of that phenomenon, which again reflects how this sort of identity politic, the sort of race-based, the transgender and LGBTQ plus identity-based sort of attacks have started to really create more and more of a wedge, which the calculation on the right is that's a wedge that's sufficient to allow them to retain power. Now, I think at some point, if that doesn't hold, they're already looking ahead and saying, well, now we got to delegitimize elections because clearly that's not the winning strategy for us anymore. But in Maine, in 2024, only 14% of the electorate were ticket splitters. So we have consolidated significantly in terms of how people are voting. And I think that's a very interesting phenomenon. And I think to the election coming up at the end of this year, it will be the first election that Susan Collins is running in which the sitting president is not in her party, except for, and it's the only time in our nation's history when the party in power didn't lose seats in the U.S. Senate, was post 9/11, when President Bush was president, the 2002 election. So that was the only other time that Susan Collins has had to run in which the sitting president was of her same party. And it was the only other time, it was the only time in our nation's history when that trend was bucked of sort of the sitting president in recent history.
Predictions on that election?
I think you got to get through the primary first. And I think this is a very fascinating primary on the Democratic side, right? You have in Graham Plattner, someone who again reflects some of that populist energy and is tapping into a certain kind of grievance. And I think to your point, Sue, does he ultimately reflect a vision and an understanding that's about a power reset versus power consolidation? I think folks on the right are going to portray him as, you know, a radical whatever, whatever, and they're going to want you to think he's just in it for himself. I think what's so interesting, again, historically, is what he represents, though, is an understanding of the need to build a movement in order to push back against the consolidation of power and resources that is evident in our system today. And again, there's a good reference in history that way, which is, you know, in the 1900s, when we were trying to ratify an income tax amendment in this state, in this country, it was J.D. Rockefeller who stood in the way of that in New York State and really lined up all of his political cronies and made a lot of big payouts to sort of keep it from passing. And it actually failed four times in the New York legislature. But it wasn't until lawmakers started to hear the Tammany Hall clan, those folks started to hear from their constituents and understand and appreciate that lower income people were tired of services not working for them. But ultimately, they were able to thwart the power of that wealth and that sort of corrupt system through an election and through lifting their voices to hold their elected officials accountable. And I think that's what's interesting, at least in what potentially Plattner represents. I think what Mills represents for some people is sort of a safe path that's familiar and tried and true. She's not necessarily going to generate the same level of excitement, but you sort of trust that she's going to deliver in some ways that feel very familiar. And if that's your sort of cup of tea, then you'll sip that. Once we get through that, all bets are off, right? Susan Collins has proven herself to be amazingly resilient. But I think this, without question, both situationally and in terms of her oppositional opponent, whether that's Mills or Plattner, quite frankly, this will be the toughest race she's had to face.
Well, I imagine, I mean, this is fabulous. I know so little about Maine politics, but it's wonderful to learn I imagine that the decline in split ticket voting may also have to do with the sort of nationalization of politics that Maine voters are recognizing that, you know, whatever they feel about Susan Collins, pro or con, that they're playing with the balance of power in the national Senate. So that could alter their choices.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, Sue, you know, one of the great things about doing the kind of work that we do in Maine in terms of working with lawmakers to advance policies that ensure that all Maine people have a fair shot at a good life is sort of the how few degrees of separation there are. Like people really do. I think the civic life in Maine is still strong in the sense that people understand that that we are government still. Like they know their local selectmen, you know, board. They know those people, even though it's the most thankless job in the state of Maine, quite frankly. We have the citizen legislature that's term limited. You know, it's fascinating that way. And at the same time, I think it's an interesting observation about the nationalization of the politics and of the policies, because I do think where Susan Collins in particular has been very strong through the years has been her connection to people and community. You know, there is that affinity, that relationship that feels authentic and true. And there's a sense that she reflects those interests. But I think that started to definitely fray with the Kavanaugh decision. And, you know, some other very high profile decisions where I think people started to say, well, you know, I really like her and I really trust her, but I'm not sure at the end of the day that she's actually going to represent my interests in the way I thought she might. And so that's another piece of the puzzle is how much does the nationalization ultimately hurt people who have been able to sort of navigate these waters based on that more personal, localized brand. When the sort of curtain gets pulled back, you start to realize, oh, this is just part of a bigger chessboard that we haven't necessarily seen or appreciated.
You're tuned to the Democracy Forum on WERU-FM. This is Ann Luther from the League of Women Voters of Maine. Our guests this afternoon are Garrett Martin, President and CEO of the Maine Center for Economic Policy, and Sue Stokes, the Tiffany and Margaret Blake Distinguished Service Professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Chicago. This program was pre-recorded on January 13th. No listener calls are being taken right now. So, Sue, I want to just ask you one more big question, then I want to get to what we can maybe do about it. Has this concentration of wealth and income been an intentional 40-year project going back to the mid-70s in the U.S.? And is that true globally? And has the goal actually been over this whole time to lay down a plan to concentrate power in the elite? Or has this just been one opportunistic moment after another that led this to blossom right now?
I don't think that there was a group of people sitting around a table in, you know, 1975 who said, hey, let's change the global economic structure and let's change the fiscal policy in such a way that we're going to, you know, produce a very unequal world or America or UK or what have you 40, 50 years hence. I do think that, you know, there were a number of sort of strategies and decisions that sort of led in that direction. And then once you get, you know, people who are benefiting from a kind of political economic system in big time and are extremely powerful, then that begins to feed on itself. And then it is more guided by intentional interest. But what you see in a lot of countries is center-left governments in the post-war years shifting attention somewhat away from working class constituencies. And some of that had to do with just electoral incentives, you know. Countries were developing the structure, you know, sort of the blue collar working class was beginning to shrink. Labor unions eventually were losing power. The percentages of people in a whole swath of Northern European and to some extent U.S. eventually countries were getting college education. So it was a kind of natural move I don't think that social democratic parties and the Democratic Party made a decision to abandon the working class. I think they were facing electoral incentives, and that if there was a mistake, it was sort of not to think about, you know, some number of decades hence, we're opening up a flank that kind of anti-state and ethno and xenophobic version of our competitors on the right can come in and take advantage of. So, but On the other hand, it is certainly the case that we have a very long tradition in the United States of powerful corporate interests, from railroads to, you know, gas barons to tech bros, using their power and influence very effectively, and their money very effectively, to influence our politics. In fact, the U.S. is sort of often an extreme in the degree to which money influences politics. If you compare, say, the U.S. and the U.K. for more than a century, we have had a system that allows, through various channels, for moneyed interest to have an influence on politics in ways that have not been true in that country, and tend not to be true in other countries where you have public financing of elections, where you have more, you know, tighter regulation about political donations. And I'm not just talking, you know, sort of post Citizens United. Going back to the 19th century, we were a country in which elections were very much controlled by parties, but at the state level, and where there was a lot of room for money to have a sway.
Once that thing kind of gets going, though, there's sort of a feedback loop that starts to accelerate it.
One day you wake up and you know, the wealthiest man on the planet is offering $1 million checks to people to register, you know, register friends. And the joke on him is that doesn't always work. You know, I mean, money doesn't always, that kind of crass use of money in politics doesn't always work. Sometimes the less well-funded candidate wins, and, you know, sometimes those moneyed interests are frustrated. But yeah, no, it's, you know, and honestly, in the world we're living in now in the United States, we have almost a cartoon caricature of the sort of magnates, swaying politics, and politicians at the highest level engaging in absolutely corrupt politics, where they're basically selling access and public policy to the highest bidder, some of which we know about, and I'm sure there's a ton of it that we don't know about. So it's pretty extreme. I think so. Shorthand answer to your question is less so several decades ago was this a sort of, you know, a conspiracy of rich people, more so when we get toward the present day.
So Garrett, what can we do about it?
I just have to come back to the consolidation of wealth thing for a hot sec.
Yeah, sure.
And, you know, I think there is this phenomenon that it's not only about government being able to do its job effectively, it's also about how the rules are structured around private enterprise. One way in which we see that manifest itself is sort of this divide between what the typical worker gets and what the typical CEO gets paid. And, you know, if the way I like to think about it is, if you think of a little Lego man, for those of you who had Lego blocks out there, you know, that if that's the typical worker in 1975, the typical CEO would have been looked like a golden retriever, so 2 feet tall. So roughly they were, in 1975, a CEO was earning 25 times higher than the average worker. Today, that figure, if you were to use that Lego figure as your same benchmark, in Maine, everybody knows the Paul Bunyan statue. That statue is 31 feet tall. You would need two Paul Bunyans to get what corporate CEO pay on average is in 2024, which was 300 times higher than the average worker. How is it that when a business succeeds, it actually succeeds on the efforts of its workers? But for some reason, since the 1970s, even though these businesses have gotten more productive, more profitable, the money's gone to those guys who showed up at the inauguration. I mean, that picture of Elon Musk with Jeff Bezos and Mark Zuckerberg standing at the inauguration, was, people should be offended by that, right? Tesla paid zero corporate taxes in a year after the 2017 tax cuts went through. That was not by accident. That was by design. And the challenge we face for folks who are good government people, though, is governments, we got to make sure government's working for people. One of the things that I loved in a commentary about Mamdani was he sort of understands sewer politics, which means not that he gets in the sewer and, you know, does things, but that he makes sure the sewer system's going to work. I mean, one of my favorite memes was, there goes that socialist snowplow. I drive down east a lot. My in-laws live, you know, on the Blue Hill Peninsula. And when I cross from one town to the other, I always know which town's going to have the better road plow, right? And I know why, because I know the road commissioner, and I know that he cares deeply about the job he's doing, and he doesn't see himself as a socialist. Now, he's a Trump supporter, but he understands the value of local government structure and of a local government job in his community. And so you can still have a conversation with the person. So I think that's part of the solution, Anne, is we need to really help people connect the dots between what they're seeing in their own lives and what how these decisions that are being made sort of play out. And I think fundamentally, you know, that's the most pressing challenge. You know, we're all being besieged by daily deluge of sort of news, and it's hard to make heads or tails out of what matters anymore in some respects, right? But what we do know is that if we allow power of this type to exist unchecked, and we allow the corruption and the greed to win out over sort of our collective interest and desire to lift up our communities and the people around us, we're done. And the only way we can have an effective voice in that is by making sure the structures of governance that we have in place that have worked in this country for almost 250 years, which are currently in peril, that we reclaim those. And I think that is a discussion that sounds like it's a little hyperbolic, but is not. You know, you look at sort of the Supreme Court, the legislative branch. If we do not have free and fair elections in the next presidential election cycle, where do we go from here?
Susan, what does your research show about countries recovering from this kind of democracy backsliding? What do they do to get out of it?
You know, with full honesty, we're pretty early in this drama still. And so we don't have a lot of evidence collected on sort of what works, what doesn't work. But we do have some good sort of anecdotal evidence. And, you know, certainly the people matter. Common people really matter in this drama. So one of the comparisons that I draw in my book is between Democratic backsliding under the Trump administration one and two in the U.S., a kind of lurch toward Democratic backsliding in the U.K. during the government of Boris Johnson. It didn't proceed so far in the U.K., and a big reason it didn't proceed so far is that Johnson's party dumped him. And the reason his party dumped him was that he had lost support among voters, and in particular among conservative voters. So whereas Trump has that high and almost, you know, unshakable level of support among the Republican electorate, you know, probably slipping now, but certainly through his first term. Johnson's popularity among conservative voters was very much up and down and went down, and so his party's, you know, put the kibosh on him. And, you know, and that's an example of voters indirectly through their parties anticipating bad electoral results having an impact and taking out somebody whose instincts were very much autocratizing and kind of dictatorial. So voters really matter. Public opinion matters. Courts matter a lot. You know, what we've seen in the first months of the first year of the second Trump administration is that one of the only real checks on presidential power and its abuse has been the federal courts below the level of the Supreme Court. So there's always that big asterisk that's sort of like, well, what's going to happen when it gets to the Supreme Court? But below the levels of the Supreme Court, the federal courts have been really important in reasserting the rule of law. And I mean, it's, you know, here in Illinois, here in Chicago, I'm a pretty plugged in, you know, I read the newspaper every day and so on. I couldn't have told you the names of our local federal judges. And now they're, you know, we know them because they're heroes. They're the people who say, who say, no, you know, ICE, you can't go around pepper spraying people without warning them. And I want you to come in, Mr. Bovino, every afternoon at 5 o'clock and tell me what you've done today and so on and so forth. So that's been important. And that isn't just the U.S. That's also been important in other countries. You know, Shakespeare said, first, let's kill all the lawyers. Well, now what we're saying is, boy, let's go run to the lawyers. And obviously, they're mixed, like all of us. It's a mixed bag. There have been law firms that have very much taken the knee under pressure with the Trump administration. But there's also immensely important work being done by lawyers who are protecting our rights and protecting the rights of migrants and refugees and so on.
We are running out of time, and I do want to give you each a minute or two to wrap up and, you know, cap this off, focusing especially on what we can do in the run-up to the 2026 election and otherwise. So, Garrett, you first. Take a minute. Take us out.
First of all, thank you for the conversation, Sue. It's been great to participate with you. I think about the ice storm of 1998 here in Maine, Ann, and the connections that people made with each other and the community that we had in place at that time. And I think a lot of people understand and appreciate the value of community in Maine, and that's our strength. And we need to stay engaged with each other. I think that's first and foremost. I think we also need to stay engaged civically. As it relates to broader policymaking, we need to tax the rich, right? Because it's the consolidation of wealth and money that has fostered this power, and we need to make sure we continue to protect our election systems. You know, I will go out with a quote from Aunt Vanessa Williamson's book again, The Price of Democracy, and she says, "Elite's fear of taxation is a fear of democracy itself. It is not a complicated calculus. Oligarchs want democracy to be poor and weak so that they can be richer and more powerful. The possibility that people of moderate means would have a say over the tax system has persistently led wealthy people to undermine government's democratic practices and fiscal capacity." When you look at the only real signature piece of legitimate legislation that this administration has passed in its first term and in its current term, it was all about taxes and cutting taxes for the wealthy while cutting programs and services, healthcare, food assistance for poor and working people. We need to reverse that equation and call that bluff.
Thank you, Garrett. Go ahead, Sue, your final thoughts.
So first, I before I answer, I want to just underline Garrett's point and say that, you know, some years ago, the evidence that political scientists dug up suggested that Americans are sort of ambivalent about taxes, that we you know, so for the, you know, inheritance tax, that we kind of somehow think that we're going to fall subject to it. And even if we never will in our lives, we may have ambivalence about it. That's really changed. So public opinion in the United States is much more in favor of a kind of strong shift toward a much more progressive tax system, as Garrett's comments suggest. I'm also in accord with the idea that making government work. We lost one of our great mayors several decades back because her administration couldn't clear the streets after a big storm out here. That's got to happen. I'll just say, as an Illinoisan, while I'm on the topic, you guys may be a cul-de-sac, but you're a real beautiful cul-de-sac.
Thank you, Sue.
Final word, like, you know, what do we do? So we're in a weird situation in the United States today where the government is basically autocratic. So, you know, at least the executive branch is autocratic. And yet we live in a system that's still democratic. And so we have this kind of a little bit of a schizophrenia going on. But we, the people who live in the democratic system, need to keep living that out, because part of what protects it is our exercise of our rights. So going out, protesting, not being cowed, voting. Don't be scared by claims that they're going to somehow take over these elections. We go and we vote and we get our neighbors to vote just as we would, because that's, you know, doing it makes it more solid, makes it more protected.
We got to go out now. Thank you both so much for this conversation. That's our show for today. Our guests this afternoon were Garrett Martin, President and CEO of the Maine Center for Economic Policy, and Susan Stokes, the Tiffany and Margaret Blake Distinguished Service Professor at the Department of Political Science, University of Chicago. You've been listening to the Democracy Forum, a project of the League of Women Voters Down East, produced in cooperation with WERU-FM. We're streaming at WERU.org. If you have a comment about this show, you can send it to news@WERU.org. Please put Democracy Forum in the subject line. The League's website is lwvme.org for more information about this topic or to learn about other shows in this series. You can subscribe to our podcast at lwvme.org. Thanks for listening. We'll see you here next month.